Welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. All of the talk of a Western peace settlement of the conflict in Ukraine hasn't produced much. For the most part, the West wants the conflict to continue against Russia. Importantly, the West courts Trump's favor. Meanwhile, Russia moves forward with its own settlement plans. To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, Alexander Pavic in Belgrade. He's a member of the Serbian parliament. And here in Moscow, we have Dmitry Babic. He is the deputy foreign editor at Komsomolskaya Pravda Daily. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's start out in Belgrade. Alexander, it's we have kind of a tale of two settlements going on here, and they're running parallel. And they don't have any points of contact, at least from what I can tell thus far. We have, on the one hand, we have a West that is confused, going at cross purposes, very often illogical, not taking into account facts on the ground, ignoring past the recent past, particularly the last 10 years. A lot of squabbling, and the point of nexus is Donald Trump. Trump is on our side. Trump agrees with us. Well, if you look at the time, the New York Times, the Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, they're running fabrications. Trump has not agreed to very much of what the Europeans want. And then we have the other side, Istanbul 2.0. And from what I can see, the Russian side is just picking up where they left off when the Ukrainians unilaterally walked away in the spring of 2022. Very different trajectories, and I don't see any point where they're going to connect anytime soon. Your thoughts, Alexander?
Well, first, I'm shocked that the Washington Post and New York Times, shocked that they're publishing fabrications. I mean, really. but, you know, that's par for the course. And as you say, two parallel courses, parallel lines never meet. And unfortunately, it seems that's the way it's going to go. As long as we have this this EU deep state that's trying to prolong the war as much as possible, they don't want to give up on the war because they never had a plan B. Plan A was the only plan they had, and it was regime change in Moscow. Let's be really clear about that. The only consolation prize they were prepared to accept was a fatally weakened Moscow with a puppet government, return to the 90s type of government, Yeltsin 2.0. That would be a kind of a something they would settle for if they couldn't do a classic regime change. So their problem is Trump won the elections in Washington. They couldn't steal them this time like they did in 2020. We no longer have a collective West. And no matter what the Western media are saying, Trump is obviously a lot closer to Putin's point of view than he is to the point of view of anyone in the EU, except for Orban, for Viktor Orban, I would say, and probably Robert Fico. And that's the problem that the EU is being faced with right now. Trump practically shut down their plan of pushing Russia into a corner with the demand for a 30-day ceasefire. Trump just, you know, said, no, you should meet. You should accept Putin's offer to meet in Istanbul, and he shut them down cold. They had a good conversation, two-hour conversation, as Trump said himself, both of them said it, and the worst thing maybe for them is what Trump said at the end. He said the two sides should talk directly, meaning he's not pushing the EU as any sort of a mediator or anyone from the West. You know, that's what's called a stake through the heart of the vampire.
Well, what it also does, Alexander, and I'll move, I'll pass it over to Dima here, is Trump has basically said, I brought them to the table. They're sitting at the table. Get to work, gentlemen. Thank you very much. I've got a taxi to catch. Bye. That's what he wants to do. Yeah, obviously, it is his war because he is president of the United States. But I do understand what he means is that I didn't bring this about, at least to this magnitude. And he doesn't, he has a lot of other things on his mind here. You know, Dima, when I look at Western, you know, the new peace plans coming out and it's all being discussed and all that. When I look at the Russian side, well, they just continue to continue what they're doing, okay? It's no secret in the Russian media that, there are Russian forces preparing for a new offensive, the summer offensive, they're calling it. We had a prisoner exchange, which was par for the course. I mean, all of this white noise in the West doesn't seem to really impact Russian decision-making whatsoever, and the West doesn't pick up on that. The fear of sanctions is ridiculous. What else are you going to sanction? Okay, I mean, it's done, and it's failed. And so, you know, again, you know, these two parallel tracks, the Russians will just continue to say, we're going to keep doing what we're doing until you want to go sit back at the table like you did in 2022, and then we can solve the problem. Will it be to Russia's advantage? Probably. Will it be to Ukraine's disadvantage? Probably. But that's what happens when you lose a war. Dima.
Well, first I would like to say that, of course, Russia wants the war to end. You know, we want peace more than anyone else because our people are dying on both sides. This is the major difference between Putin and Zelensky. Zelensky considers us enemies, subhumans, you know, the people whom he openly hates. Putin has been saying for a long time, Ukrainians and Russians are one people. This is disputable. There are various points of view about that in Russia. But that just shows you that for him, you know, the death of Ukrainians is a pain, you know. Mm-hmm. But look at what happens. Look what is happening. The Western media is not covering it all. They report on Russian strikes against military objects in Ukraine, but there were hundreds of Ukrainian drones attacking Russian cities in the last week, especially on the 9th of May, on our victory day. It was unprecedented. So what Russia is doing is basically responding to these drone attacks. But this is filled in the West, you know. The Western TV companies are carrying it. They're not carrying footage from Tula, which was attacked today. And Tula is a Russian heartland, you know. This is where no invader, you know, not Napoleon, not even Hitler managed to get there. So obviously there is no will for peace on the Ukrainian side and on the Western side. And here I agree with Alexander. He says it is EU deep state. I would say it's ultra-liberal Western ideology, which is the same in the EU, in South Korea, you know. And Trump, the only advantage that he has a lot of disadvantages, he does not believe in this ideology. So that makes him suddenly very different. Look what happened just recently. He lifted the sanctions on Syria. Okay, belatedly, Syria has a terrible government now. But I still think people should not suffer. So, and the EU keeps the sanctions. You know, they say, okay, there was a revolution in Syria. We're happy, but it is such a pain in the neck to change the rules. Let them starve for another year or another 2 years.
You know, Tim, you bring up a really good point, Alexander. This is, you know, I agree with it's. This is ideologically driven, but there's an element of neocolonialism. I mean, I'm reflecting upon your first answer there, that for some reason, the Europeans have the right to determine what governments should rule and which ones don't. They have the right to say an election is good or an election is bad. I mean, I'm thinking of Romania, okay, or the sham election in Moldova. And yeah. we have a figure in Kyiv that no longer has a legal mandate. But it doesn't matter because it's Europe. Europe decides what's kosher and what's not kosher. Alexander.
Yes. We go back to what the previous EU figures have been saying. You know, those parallels, like the EU is a garden and outside of the EU is the jungle.
Joseph Borrell, yes, yeah.
Yes, and we had Robert Cooper back 20 years ago. He was a close aide to Tony Blair, who said double standards are actually okay. We need to apply double standards because we're civilization. Everything outside of civilization is, you know, the wilderness, and we need to tame the beasts, you know, and that's the way the West has been looking at the rest of the world for centuries, actually, and they can't get used to the fact that they're no longer the chief, the main, you know, the rulers of the world, the ones who set the rules. They're still clinging to this fiction of a rules-based order, where they make up the rules as they go along and change them if they don't suit them anymore. That's very different from international law. They tried to impose that on the rest of the world, but unfortunately, Russia has been getting on its feet for the last 20 years. China, you can't any longer do that. And plus, we have an administration in Washington who's openly saying, yes, the world is multipolar. That's a normal state of affairs. The world has mostly been multipolar throughout history, and it should be multipolar again. In that kind of a world, the EU is absolutely outdated. They're obsolete. How can they impose their own rules on a multipolar order?
Well, there's the assumption that their ideas are is power in itself, which is absurd. It has nothing to do with geopolitics, okay? I mean, geopolitics, folks, everybody watching this here, doesn't care about regime character. It just doesn't, okay? Power is power, but ideas are not power on the international stage. Dima, jump in.
They like to talk about dictatorship, personalist dictatorship. But there is also a dictatorship of ideology, which is worse than personal dictatorship, because there can be benevolent dictators. History knows a lot of that. But a radical ideology, like the one they have in the West now, it has no pity, it has no human feelings, it has no fear. It's not afraid of a nuclear war. For the ideology, what is important for any ideology is its victory. Okay, there are many nice ideologies, social democracy, Christian socialism, but they're all dead in the West. The only one left is the so-called liberal ideology, which is basically ultra-liberal. And what we see how it makes people poorer, because if you have a monopoly on ideology, why not have a monopoly in economy? Why not have a monopoly in culture? You know, we have basically one set of values, one set of ideas, which are kind of recycled in the West during the last 30 years. All the other ideas are filtered out.
Well, ultimately, Dima, it outlaws dissent, because this ultra-liberalism makes the claim that this is the pinnacle of the human condition. I mean, it's really remarkable. It's kind of like what existing socialism in the Soviet Union in the 1970s. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here, and we're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Ukraine. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Remind you, we're discussing Ukraine. I want to go back to Belgrade. Alexander, when I talk to people about how to end this conflict, which was intentionally made difficult to end, we saw that, you know, Trump-proofing and all of this we saw before the election last year in the United States. But I think the fundamental issue really at play, and it's something Western leaders and pundits don't like to talk about because it demands their culpability, and it's a one word. It's a simple word. It's a one syllable word. It's called trust. And when I make my position clear that this conflict will come to an end when the battlefield determines it, because there's no way the Russian leadership, after particularly the history of the entire Cold War and the post-Cold War, has any reason whatsoever to trust anything that a Western politician says, not even a document, okay, that is signed. That's really the difficulty that we have here. And with the lack of trust, then Russia will, under its own terms and conditions, come to the conclusion of a peace settlement when its security is satisfied. That's a conversation people in the West don't want to have, Alexander.
No, they don't. You know, during the Cold War, there was this phrase, trust but verify. Yeah. You can't even verify with these people. They don't want to let you verify. And even if you verify, the next day, they'll go back on their word. The most recent experience Russia has had is with the Minsk agreements. You know, what more proof do you need? I mean, I can go, and the Russians have been watching very carefully a former Yugoslavia, Serbia, Kosovo. We still have a live, living resolution, UN Security Council Resolution 1244, which three of the five member states have trampled. The US, Great Britain, and France, they recognized so-called Kosovo, even though the resolution clearly states that it's part of Serbia, and the final settlement is supposed to be at the end of negotiations, which never ended. We have the Dayton Agreement in Bosnia and Herzegovina, which the U.S. brokered in 1995, and the ink wasn't even dried, and they already were at work in trying to modify it, talking not about the letter of the agreement, but the spirit of the agreement, and we know where that can lead us. So we both have vast experience with the reliability of the West. So what's left? It's just like what you said, on the ground. What you have on the ground, what you hold on the ground, in the end, that's all they can respect, unfortunately, but that's the way it is. And the West is to blame for it, not Russia, not Serbia, not China, not anyone else.
One of the problems, again, all of us are looking think tankers are coming up with a ceasefire, a truce, some kind of resolution. And it always ends up being Minsk 3.0. And all of us know that the first Minsk 1 and Minsk 2 were grossly violated. We know Halan and Merkel publicly talked about this, okay? When I confront someone about, oh, no, they never said that. I mean, how do you deal with people that say, oh, they never said that? That's a Kremlin talking point. I mean, if among punditry and think tankers and all that, we can't have a set agreed facts, how can politicians do it? Because politicians are notoriously known for being economical with the truth. But if we can't have a solid playing ground of what facts are, it's no mystery that they keep going back to, oh, we have to go back to the Minsk process. Well, the Minsk process died on the first day of the special military operation. Dima.
Well, not only the Minsk process, but also, let me remind our viewers, they can check their databases. In February 2014, there was a truce between Yanukovych and the violent opposition, guaranteed by the ministers of foreign affairs of France, Germany, and Poland.
Yep.
The minister of foreign affairs of Germany is the German president now. So before the ink even dried on that agreement, on the same day, you know, Maidan crowd burned several people alive, continued its attack, and the West applauded and never reproached, the Maidan people for basically breaching.
Well, you know what, Dima, if the rules-based order were actually in play, European capitals, including Washington, should have denied legitimacy of the coup regime and started sanctioning it. But no, it's amazing. On the same day they signed this document, the next day, Yanukovych, you never met the guy. We don't know who this guy is. I mean, that's how blatant it is. And so Alexander, go ahead, Dima, finish up.
Yeah, just finishing about the truce. It's not coincidental that I mentioned Korea. You know, the example that they usually give is 1953, when the truce gradually, grew into something like peace,
Well, or the lack of hostilities.
The lack of war, exactly. But that's not going to work now. First, because the West has changed. In 1953, first, Stalin did not want the war to continue, so he pressured, he has been pressuring Kim Il-sung to basically reach a compromise. And the West was unwilling to continue fighting, and the UN was then a powerful body, you know. It could enforce its resolution on both sides, you know. The UN had inspectors watching that the West would not send weapons to South Korean army. Now it's a completely different situation. And the West is to blame for it. I mean, after 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed, a lot of people expected the North Korean problem to be resolved in the German way, reunification of East Germany and West Germany. But then Koreans in the North, they saw what happened in Germany, whereas Germans became second-class citizens. That was in store for North Koreans. So now that solution is no longer on the table. North Korea will develop on its own, opening contacts to China, Russia. In this way, it will be living its isolation, and I'm sure it will vanquish poverty. It will become richer thanks to a connection to these countries. It was the West that made the reunification solution impossible. Their policy, the examples that North Koreans see everywhere in the world. That's why they supported us in this war, out of principle, not for material reasons. They just don't want to be the next. So they supported Russia out of principle.
You know, Alexander, the West likes to claim that it invented democracy and it is the great protector of democracy and it is the great exemplar of democracy. But I've never come across in the last 3 years any European polity that has been asked their opinion about this conflict in Ukraine. Can you think of one case where Europeans were saying, do you vote for this? Because we had the former German foreign minister, Annalena 360 Baerbock, she's saying, I don't care what my voters think about Ukraine.
Yeah, we didn't have any sort of a referendum, no. But we did have peace candidates in Romania.
There we go.
And what happened? Well, the elections were annulled. Why? Because the wrong candidate won. The pro-peace candidate won in the first round in December. And now, you know, they practically stole the election from his successor. It's obvious.
Mathematically, there's no rhyme or reason to the outcome that they claim. I mean, those kind of shifts are just never seen in elections. It's just inconceivable.
And then they were toying with the idea of banning the AfD in Germany. It was only, I think, mostly because of pressure from the United States that they backed off, probably just temporarily.
For now.
Yeah. And banning Marine Le Pen from politics, because she's also an anti-war candidate as well. So that's, you know, whenever somebody appears that's not interested in waging war against Russia, the biggest nuclear power in the world, the EU jumps in and says, no, we want more war. But you know what their problem is? Their problem is the following. I would say the problem is similar to what Stalin said about the Vatican after the war. He asked, how many divisions does the Pope have? The EU is sort of like the Vatican. They still need the United States in order to present some sort of a tough face, a front against Russia. But the new president, the new administration is not interested in that. So what they're trying to do, I think, is buy time until they can build up their own European army.
No, Alexander, I think they're just waiting for the midterms in the United States. That's what they're waiting for. They just want to see if they can ride it out. It's illusory. This is a fever dream they have. We're rapidly running out of time. You know, Dima, as the prisoner exchange is coming to an end, the Russians have announced that they will have their peace memorandum to present, presumably, to the Ukrainians and the world. Do you expect any surprises, Dima?
I expect that it will be centered on security and rights, human rights of Russians and non-Russians in Ukraine mostly. Right. It will be less about territory. It will be more about security and rights. And, to pick up a little bit on Europe, you know, one of the plans announced by Bloomberg is that Europe will buy weapons from the U.S. and give it to Ukrainians. And the question is, did anyone in Europe vote for that? Is it democracy? You know, what we see in Europe is basically trampling on everything, not only democracy, but property rights. You know, when so-called Russian oligarchs and simple Russian citizens suddenly lost their property.
Well,
the
theft of $300 billion is the biggest heist in history. It's the biggest robbery in history.
So let me finish on this. You know, strangely, the founding fathers of the American Republic never wrote the word democracy in their documents. They talked about freedom, about property rights, about freedom of speech. What happened in Europe is that they not only lost democracy, they lost all of these other things, which very special, limited U.S. democracy was supposed to protect. They lost...
Dima, I hate to interrupt you mid-thought, but we've run out of time. I want to thank my guests in Belgrade and here in Moscow. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.